Welcome to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. My name is Sally Higginbottom and today I'm interviewing Dr. Sam Merriel. Sam is a GP in North Somerset and a Clinical Senior Research Fellow at the University of Exeter. He's currently undertaking research into prostate cancer diagnosis and the role of multiparametric MRI in primary care, funded by Cancer Research UK. Hello, Sam.
Hello, Sally.
In this podcast, we're discussing the recent module about prostate cancer testing. So what's this module based on?
This module is based on a series of recent articles published in the BMJ in late 2018. They looked at some of the new evidence that had come to light around prostate cancer screening, and they formed a rapid recommendation to update clinical practice.
So it's based on new information from last year. But let's go back to the beginning. Prostate cancer is really common, and I see the modules quoting a lifetime risk of 1 in 8 men and 1 in 4 in black men. But much prostate cancer doesn't shorten life. So how do you think about prostate cancer?
I think prostate cancer still represents a significant challenge for us as GPs. So from a diagnosis point of view, you know, the PSA or prostate specific antigen test has become more widely used in recent decades, and that's felt to be driving a lot of new diagnosis of men with low-risk disease that won't shorten their life, as you said. And as a screening test, it's got some limitations, which this BMJ article series looked at in more detail. I think there are other things that we have in general practice that can still aid us in terms of diagnosis. So, you know, digital rectal exam still has a role and can add a bit of extra information on top of PSA. And this issue of diagnosing men with low-risk disease and trying to give a man a good idea of their prognosis is also a challenge in this field. At the moment, it is still challenging to sort of say to a man who's got prostate cancer that's just localized to the prostate and hasn't spread whether he's going to have one of those aggressive tumors that we would advocate they consider treatment for versus one of these lower-risk tumors that may not have a significant impact on his quality of life or his mortality.
Thinking about risk, ethnicity is a big risk factor, and I think we're largely aware of that. What are the risk factors do we need to remember?
When we're seeing a man and we're trying to assess what his risk of prostate cancer might be, family history is an important one to think about. If your father has it, you are at an increased risk. And again, if you've got a sibling that's had prostate cancer under the age of 60, then your risk also increases. Age is the other major driver of risk for prostate cancer. Men are at higher risk the older they get. But conversely, their risk of dying from prostate cancer if they're diagnosed at an older age is relatively low because prostate cancer in general is a fairly slow growing tumour for most of them. There has been some discussion about other risk factors such as obesity and some association with lower socioeconomic status, but the evidence there is a lot weaker. So really the key things for a GP to think about is what's the patient's ethnicity, what is their family history, if any, for prostate cancer, and thinking about their age and their other comorbidities.
And thinking about PSA, something that was new for me in the module was thinking about which drugs can affect your results. Obviously, the drugs that are hormonally active, I would expect to affect the results, but there were others as well.
I think a lot of GPs, when they think about PSA and how to interpret it, are aware of the things that can push your prostate up. So the man has a very large prostate. If their prostate has been recently examined through a digital rectal exam, if they've got bladder infections, prostate infections, recent intercourse or recent vigorous exercise, all these things can push it up. But as you say, there are some things that can lower the PSA as a blood-based marker. So it doesn't change the effect whether they have prostate cancer or not, but it makes interpretation of PSA slightly different. So as you say, things that act on the prostate that we already use in clinical practice, such as the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors like finasteride or dutasteride, they can lower a man's PSA, need to be thought about. But there are other unrelated drugs, as you said, such as statins and thiazide diuretics that can also bring the PSA level down. We do also see some men who are obese having lower PSA levels, and that, again, may relate to hormonal changes as a result of excess weight. So these things do need to be kept in mind when you're assessing a man's risk for prostate cancer and you perform a PSA as part of your assessment to think about these factors.
In practice, do you mentally adjust by a certain percentage, or do you just bear in mind that it might be falsely lower than the reality?
I don't think we understand clearly enough whether you need to adjust by a certain factor for medications or things that can lower the PSA. I think it's something you just need to keep in mind. If you're thinking this man is at increased risk, but the PSA is, say, borderline, and they're on these things, you maybe need to think, or maybe it's artificially bringing it down. But there's no hard and fast guidance on a certain percentage adjustment as there are for other blood tests.
And you mentioned a PR examination earlier. Do you think we should always do a PR when we're doing a PSA? And if so, should we do the PSA first and then the PR?
In answer to your first question, yes, I think a DRE does add further clinical information when you're trying to assess the risk of prostate cancer in any man. Understandably, some men are a bit hesitant about that, and certainly some men from particularly ethnic backgrounds are quite averse to having that examination, but that conversation needs to be had because it does add extra clinical information. There was a recent systematic review looking at the value of DRE for assessing for prostate cancer in primary care, and actually, if you examine the prostate and you think you feel something abnormal, about half the time we're right. So I think it's not a hard and fast sign, but if you do examine the prostate and you do feel something abnormal, there is a 50-50 chance there will be a tumour there, and it does add a bit of extra clinical information. And yes, it needs to be at a time separate to the PSA test. So if you examine the prostate and then take a PSA within a few days, it can artificially raise the PSA level, which can change your interpretation of the results. So it is important that if you're going to examine the prostate that you wait. Generally, a week is a good rule of thumb before doing the PSA test.
Thinking about prostate cancer screening, this question comes around periodically. What's the official position?
If you look at national guidance from within the UK and look wider and in Europe and North America, almost all of them recommend against systematic screening. So that's why we don't have a national PSA-based prostate cancer screening program, because the evidence from trials in America and trials in Europe don't show enough evidence that it's of sufficient benefit versus the harms of extra testing of the prostate and treatment for diagnosed disease. So the UK national screening program still recommends against it. However, they all leave some scope for opportunistic screening. This is where GPs are well trained in discussions with men around having a PSA test if a man came to request it and they don't have symptoms. So this would be an opportunistic screening consultation. You know, we're all fairly well versed in having the conversation about this is what a PSA test is, these are the limitations of it, talking to the man and having that shared decision-making process. I personally use the leaflet that is available from Public Health England. I find it's a very simple, well-worded leaflet. It's only 2 pages and it's got a lot of good information about the benefits and also the risks of having a PSA test when a man doesn't have any symptoms.
And to be clear, we're talking about asymptomatic testing. When someone is symptomatic with lower urinary tract symptoms, we would usually offer a PSA test. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The NICE guidance around suspected cancer does recommend if you see a man with symptoms suggestive of something going on in the prostate, you should examine the prostate and you should offer a PSA test as part of your assessment to see whether they may have a prostate cancer or not.
So the paper was based on a new trial. What did the trial involve and what happened?
The reason, as you say, that these screening recommendations and the BMJ series was all done was because we had the publication of the results of the CAP trial. So this was a UK-based study and men were invited from general practices across the UK to participate in this study where they had a one-off PSA blood test. So they just did a PSA test once, and then they follow these men up for about an average of 10 years to see what happened to them. So the men who had a raised PSA test were then offered diagnostic testing to see if they genuinely had prostate cancer or not. The men who had a normal PSA test and the men who declined to have the blood test were still followed up to see how many cancers were missed, either through a false negative test or not testing. The main thing that the CAP trial found was there was no difference whatsoever in having a one-off PSA test in terms of your risk of dying overall, and there was a very small difference in your risk of dying from prostate cancer specifically. So the authors concluded that one-off PSA screen for men who don't have symptoms doesn't really change their future risk of death overall. There's been a lot of debate because the CAP trial model was very different to the other big European and American studies of prostate cancer screening, where they had a structured approach of repeated PSA tests every few years over time. But overall, they're sort of swinging the debate further towards the recommendation against a PSA-based population screening program for prostate cancer.
Yeah, so I was very struck by the figures. We don't usually spend a lot of time in these podcasts thinking about figures, but I was struck if you screen 1,000 men, you'll have 3 more men incontinent and 25 with erectile dysfunction, but no more alive at the end. And that seemed not a good deal. What do we know about the psychological effects of screening?
In terms of prostate cancer screening, very little, to be honest. So unfortunately, that kind of information hasn't been captured alongside these trials to date. I mean, it's obviously been recognised in recent times. The CAP trial did collect some quality of life data for the men that participated in the trial, but it's not been reported yet, so we don't know if that had an impact for them. I did have a little look around. I could find one study from the BJGP in 2007 that talked to men who'd had a PSA test by their GP, and that uncertainty that we feel as clinicians seemed to translate to the patients as well. That may have been related to how that discussion was framed in terms of the accuracy of PSA tests, but the men seem to pick up that, okay, this test isn't 100%, and even if it's raised, nothing may be wrong. So that seemed to translate and across to the men, but other psychological impacts, we don't really know how it impacts on men.
There is, however, something new on the horizon, which is what I think you're working on at the moment. The traditional approach of a PSA test followed by a relatively unpleasant transrectal biopsy, that era may be ending, and we may now be heading into a new era of MRI. Tell me a bit about that.
Because of the limitations we have with PSA testing, with examining the prostate, and the limitations and adverse effects from the TRUST biopsies, there's been a lot of interest in other tests for prostate cancer, and an MRI has generated a lot of interest. So there's a particular type of MRI scan called multi-parametric MRI. It's called that because they take multiple views of the prostate using different techniques with the MRI scanners. The radiologists look at the image and they have a scoring system from 1 to 5 to say how likely they think there is a cancer in the prostate or not. 5 being, yes, I think it's pretty likely, to 1 being, this looks like a completely normal prostate. And there have been a couple of trials led by investigators in the UK that have shown MPMRI has 2 potential roles. So one is, if you do an MRI in a man you suspect has prostate cancer before you biopsy them, it can help guide the urologist biopsy. So rather than ultrasound guidance, which is not sensitive enough to see the tumour when they do the biopsy, MRI is better for that. So the urologists are getting better yield from their biopsies and they're needing to take fewer samples of the prostate. So that seems to be better for men. You can also potentially use MRI as a rule out test. So for a man who's low risk of prostate cancer and their prostate looks normal on the MRI, you can potentially avoid a biopsy and the risk of missing a significant prostate cancer is low. It's not zero, but it's low. So there have been discussions about in certain groups of men, it may be safe to use the MRI as a pre-biopsy triage test to rule it out and save men a biopsy altogether. On the basis of these trials that have recently happened, NICE has actually updated their guidance for prostate cancer diagnosis and management. It was published in May this year, and they said that all men who are able to have an MRI should have one before biopsy. And this is now something that local NHS services, so that our local trusts and the Cancer Alliances are looking at how they roll that recommendation out to men in our local areas.
Yes, it is available where I work because UCH have got a big prostate cancer centre. Is it also happening where you are in Somerset?
Yeah, so we often refer our men into Bristol and they have prostate MRI services available. So not all of our men are getting it, but most are, and that's being integrated into the local diagnostic pathway for us too.
One of the things you mentioned thinking about PSA testing is a one-off test doesn't seem to be helpful. Often we end up seeing men who've already had a test maybe a year ago, maybe 3 years ago, maybe 5 years ago. How often is it reasonable to retest someone if they're requesting it?
This is another challenging area. And as you say, there are definitely groups of men who will come back asking for, you know, repeat PSA tests, and we do need to think about that. Testing every year or two, even that seems to be a bit too frequent for most men. I think if you're really worried about someone and they've been through testing and they may have seen urology, but they've, you know, not had a diagnosis, a PSA test every couple of years might be reasonable. But if you've got a man who's at lower risk or an older man with other medical problems that may be more likely to impact on their quality of life and mortality, then testing every 3 to 4 years may be more reasonable. It may even be worth writing to your local urology team. A lot of urology units are setting up advice and guidance services where you can write to them and ask for their advice on what they would do, and they may come back and give you some advice on that.
So it's another area of definite uncertainty in PSA testing. That's very helpful, but certainly not more than every couple of years in most scenarios. Was there anything else in the module or in the recent publications that you think GPs need to know about prostate cancer and PSA testing?
The fundamentals that we talk about and is a feature of our CPD learning and things and in this module have still remained. So the uncertainties around interpreting a one-off PSA result remain. Do we still have men with aggressive prostate cancer with a normal PSA? We still have a lot of men with a raised PSA who don't have prostate cancer. So we still need to keep those limitations in mind. Assessing their overall risk and sort of taking it from there, I think, is still a good approach for GPs.
That's very helpful. Thank you very much, Sam, for your time. And thank you for listening to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the RCGP.